Hey, I'm Michaela Lafrac, co-host of Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. With climate change wreaking havoc on our planet, many of us wonder, what kind of world are we leaving to our children? The Vermont author Megan Mayhew Bergman has a new book of short stories that explores this idea of inheritance amid disaster. It's called How Strange a Season. In one story, a woman re-examines her life after inheriting a glass house in coastal California. In another, a farmer struggles to maintain the peach farm left to her by her father. Megan Mayhew Bergman has written two other books of short stories. She also directs Middlebury College's Environmental Writing Program and the Breadloaf Environmental Writers Conference. She lives with her family in Shaftesbury. We began our conversation with a reading from a passage from the story Wife Days. In it, the main character, Farah, is swimming in the lake near her home and meditating on her relationship with her free-spirited mother.
She has always had some ambivalence about home. Perhaps that's because of the years she spent on the road with her mother, a band groupie, a child of the 60s, even when it was the 80s. And when her second grade teacher asked the class to draw a picture of home, she drew the inside of the Lavelle Boys of Dixie tour bus and a picture of a girl sitting on a bed surrounded by blue smoke. What is this? Her teacher had asked about the smoke, chin falling out of the neck of her floral turtleneck. Farah can still remember the taste of it in her mouth, the rich aromatic mix of tobacco and pot. And she can picture her mother rolling out of the lead singer's bed, Johnny sitting up to smooth his ponytail. His mother, her mother, would stumble for a moment in the aisle and then climb up to Farah's bed, embracing her, both of them lulled to sleep in the fetal position, jolted awake by the bus's brakes or shouting. The memory, she thinks, is rooted on a particular tour in 1987 en route to a Southern rock festival in Texas. The bus was hot. Her mother never wore a bra and pinned her hair up during the day, only to let it fall loose at night, because she said it was better for dancing. Always wear your hair down for dancing, she said. Farah filed that away as one of the few useful pieces of motherly advice she'd been given.
Farah's ambivalence about home is a theme that you seem to return to again and again in these stories. And so many of your characters are women in homes that they've either inherited or kind of fallen into homes that to me seems like they don't quite fit. What got you thinking about those themes and this concept of home?
I love that question. And I think it's a question that I think about intellectually, academically, creatively, personally. So I teach at Middlebury, as you mentioned, and one of the classes I teach is called Landscape and Memory. And I find it to be one of the most productive classes for student writing, just because I think it's productive for thinking about the way we're shaped by landscape and by home. And I think as a writer, I'm really fascinated by the way people build their lives, particularly women. And there's something about the last few years that has me really thinking about the sort of invisible expectations and systems that we participate into, you know, sort of blindly and numbly sometimes. And, you know, I think all of us are starting to think critically. Perhaps it's the pandemic or the social upheaval of the last few years, but I find myself and my peers thinking more critically about what those systems mean and what, you know, authentic home means. And I'll say I'm a deeply sentimental person, and I think part of my restlessness that comes out in my work is because I grew up in the South and I lived there for 30 years. And then I moved to Vermont right when I started publishing at about age 29 or 30. And I've been here about 12 or 13 years. And I always have this tug where the South feels like my biochemical home, but less my cultural home. And that sort of friction enters so much of my creative work.
Mm-hmm. To your own concept of home, you live on a farm in Vermont, but as you said, you grew up in the South. Do you feel ambivalent about the place you call home today, or does it feel like you've been able to place those roots?
That's a great question. It's, you know, I won't lie, it's fraught. We live in this wonderful farmhouse. It was built in 1834. You know, it totally suits my Nancy Drew complex. It's full of, you know, like we actually have like a practice tombstone in the basement. You know, we live next to a historic graveyard in Shaftesbury.
What is a practice tombstone?
Well, I mean, it might be a concept I've come up with myself, but it's, you know, it's a literal marble tombstone with just, it looks like somebody was practicing their letters on it.
Oh, wow.
And it's just in our basement and no one ever talks about it, which seems very Vermont to me. When in the South and like those of us with like a Southern Gothic tendency, we're definitely going to talk about the tombstone in the basement. But but I think for a while, when I first made this transition, I felt like this place was more of my husband's than my own. And, you know, and that tension shows up in all of my books, I think. You know, all of us are just trying to figure out who we are and what we're made of and what suits us. And I will say the pandemic deepened my relationship with this farm and with this property and with Vermont. I felt it held me and my family so safely. You know, we could grow our own food here. I could take beautiful walks. I've always appreciated nature, but I think I appreciated it that much more, just the solace that's possible in it. And so I will say the pandemic improved my relationship with the farm.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, as I read your book, I kept thinking about the concept of migration, both during the pandemic and of climate migration, of people giving up their homes to move to places like Vermont that feel safer or more well-suited to withstand rising temperatures and certain natural disasters. Is that a concept that you thought about as you wrote this book?
Absolutely. You know, within one of the stories, Inheritance, about the glass house in California, I wrote that when I was speaking in Yosemite and I'd driven over to Big Sur, but there it was during one of the landslides that had blocked off both sides of the highway on Big Sur. And I was watching, you know, a van life was sort of becoming a thing and there were people living in vans. And, you know, I had to take a rental car over a military service road just to get into Big Sur because of the mudslides. And I could just feel the precarity of this beautiful place. And I was thinking about how people, you know, in different states of privilege and lack of privilege, you're already starting to move. And we don't always call it climate migration, but I do think that's starting to, I mean, it's not starting, it's absolutely happening in lots of places. And when I integrate issues like that into fiction, I think I have a high degree of trust in my reader. And I think readers are pretty allergic to righteousness. So when I try to address something like that, I had a mentor, Amy Hempel, who always said, it has to be story first. It has to be character first. So I didn't want climate change or any kind of big issue topics to feel like they were driving the story or a sort of mechanical aspect of the plot, but I wanted it to be already very real and already pressing down on people, because I feel like it already is, as you alluded to, we're already responding to this and the ways we make choices. And it's really emotional choice. Like home is rational for some people, but it's also, I think, highly emotional. And I think in general, we've underestimated the spiritual toll that environmental degradation is going to have on us. And I think the relocation of home is just one small part of that.
Megan, I want to ask you now about rage. A lot of the women in this book seem to have a very carefully controlled rage, or rage that's bubbling up and threatening to come out onto the surface or turn into action. For you, what enrages you and how do you express those emotions?
Anger is an uncomfortable emotion. It certainly doesn't agree with the Southern lady training that I received down South as a child. But something I heard once that really revolutionized the idea of anger for me was that anger is a secondary emotion to hurt. And so often underneath what we're furious about is actually brokenheartedness or pain or tenderness. And I love honoring that complexity. And so in the stories, I often had, you know, women experiencing rage. And for me, it's intellectually important that we let women, you know, as characters in fiction, as characters in movies, any sort of media, that we let them be ugly and expansive and large and have the range of emotions that we're used to seeing men have, because I think we have them. Whether it's polite or acceptable to express them, is sort of what's up for debate. We're all human, and I think in these last few years, we're all suffering. We're lonely. We're frustrated, and so when I write, I want to honor the messiness of the human experience. So I think a lot of writers think about how do you get a character's full humanity on the page, and for me, to honor the experience that I have as a woman, and that I know that my peers and friends have, I wanted to honor the importance of rage, but also the hurt underneath it.
How do you balance teaching with writing?
That part is hard. I will say sometimes teaching helps me clarify what I think and believe about writing and what writing can do. So in my best moments, I find myself, you know, sitting with students and talking about what an incredible opportunity we have to connect with our readers, to not waste their time, to offer some sort of experience, some gift, whether it's beauty or entertainment or transcendence or taking them to some place they've never been, insight, you know, what are the things that we can actually offer the reader generously and as a gift? And I love being able to sit with young people and help them think about how to do this thing they really want to do, which is ultimately, writing is an act of connection. And for me, it's exciting to think about the opportunity to bridge divides in our very divided culture. And I think young people have an aptitude and a willingness to do that. And I love being able to serve that impulse.
I want to end with a quote that I read from an interview that you did with LitHub. They recently compiled thoughts from environmental writers about what keeps them hopeful right now in the face of climate change. And you wrote something that really struck me. You said, "I train myself to find solace in beauty, even damaged beauty." Megan, I just loved in that little line that you said that you have to train yourself to find solace in beauty, because it acknowledged the effort that it takes to do that. How exactly do you train yourself to see beauty?
Yeah, I love this question. I'm actually giving a talk to a group of psychoanalysts on this very topic, on how to develop a practice for noticing beauty. And I read that, you know, people develop a gratitude practice in order to maintain happiness. And part of the idea behind that is training the eye. And then once you start focusing on things you're grateful for, you tend to look for them. And that changes your worldview. And I think beauty can be the same way. There's a lot of scientific data out there that shows that our brain activity and contentment and feelings of solace can increase when we're looking at the forest canopy and fractals and things like that. So I think especially in this time where it feels like there's so much negative, you know, energy and information around the state of our planet, it seems to me a valuable practice to notice what's still beautiful. And, you know, there's, I think, the line that gets repeated almost every day in all conservation circles, which is, we will not love, you know, we will not save what we do not love. And I think, you know, part of it is, you know, an act of attention is an act of love.
Megan Mayhew Bergman, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.